The Lord be with you. Let's open to Genesis chapter 42 as we continue in our series through the book of Genesis. Today, the message is entitled The Gospel According to Joseph, Finding Freedom from the Deceptive Narratives That Have Shaped Our Lives. So much of the Joseph story has motifs of gospel in it, and today is certainly one of those days. I think it's perfectly timed for Easter, and hopefully we will see this as the message begins to unfold. By the time we get to Genesis 42, Joseph is quite a different man than he has been through the rest of the story. Oh, he's the same Joseph, to be sure, but he's not simply the young man spoiled by his father who pokes at his brothers in chapter 37. He's not even the man who resisted Potiphar's wife's advances or the royal officer's pressure or even that of Pharaoh. Joseph, by chapter 32, is a man in power. He is the second in command in all of Egypt. And like the God that he serves, he doesn't use his power as a way to dominate or control or punish, but to redeem. This is a story of redemption. Of course it is. That's why we love the story of Joseph so much. And because it's a story of redemption, it has so many layers of sin and the consequences of sin and how debilitating it can be upon our lives. It has the redemptive movements of God, God moving into the mess, even when at times he appears to be silent and hidden. He was always there, reconciling the world to himself. And of course, we see grace and forgiveness given to those who need it. It's extended freely, but at the expense of an innocent substitute. Last week we saw the substitute was Judah. He offered up his life as a ransom for Benjamin. Today, at the end of the message, we will see another one of the brothers who is taken as a ransom for the others. So let's dive in and look at these three great movements. First of all, the presence of sin with all of its debilitating consequences and penalties. Today, I'm using some paintings from a French artist by the name of James Tissot. He is one of these artists. He painted in the late 1800s, but there's something about his paintings that are so incredibly contemporary. And so though at times you'll say, well, that's a very different style than his other paintings, true, he painted these during different seasons of his life, but he has a whole bunch of them on the life of Joseph, and I just think they're incredible. Let's read, starting in chapter 42, verse 1. When Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you just keep looking at each other?" He continued, "I have heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us so that we may live and not die." Then 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain from Egypt, but Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with the others because he was afraid that harm might come to him. So Israel's sons were among those who went to buy grain, for the famine was in the land of Canaan also. So these four verses, tell us a lot about the effects of sin upon a family. The family is stuck in a past with little hope for the future. First, let's look at the brother's guilt and then the father's grief. First of all, the brother's guilt. And man, I think Tissot painted these guys, they all just look so guilty. This looks like a modern day lineup at the police station. And have you noticed where Jacob is? Where's Jacob? He's the one on the far right. He's the gray man. He's the only one who's looking somewhere else but the camera. He's looking down the lineup of his sons. And he can't figure out what's wrong with them. There's something deeply broken about the sons. And we really see the brothers' guilt because of the present crisis of the famine. When there's a bear market, when there's an economic crisis, or when something horrible happens to the world or to our family, the present crisis will always reveal an unresolved past. Even today, if I'm holding a cup of coffee and it's full and hot, and you accidentally bump into me and the coffee spills all over me, what comes out is a whole lot more than just the fact that my coffee spilled. It's what happened this morning. It's what happened last week. It's what happened maybe 10 years ago. And you bumping me, it all comes out. My anger is not created by you bumping me. My anger is revealed by an entire past. And so angry people, you know, you don't make angry people angry. You reveal that they are angry. And so Jacob, the poor father, he rebukes his sons. He says, "Why do you just keep looking at each other? Like, what's with you guys? There's 10 of you. And all you can find yourselves to do at a time like this is stare at each other with these accusatory looks." It's almost like he's saying, "What do you guys know that I don't know?" Oh, Jacob, if you only knew what they know that you don't know. You see, Jacob, your sons are enslaved to an unforgiven past. And every time you tell them, "Why don't you guys go to Egypt? There's food in Egypt. Come on, what's with you guys? There's 10 of you, you're grown men. Go to Egypt, go to Egypt." And every time he says the word Egypt, they think about the brother that they sold into Egypt. They all want to just close their ears and say, "Dad, would you shut up about Egypt?" So as a result of their being paralyzed by guilt and fear and shame and remorse, they've lost their capacity for creativity and leadership. Because the sin has not been dealt with, all they can do is now sit around and look at each other with no freedom to act. In order for them to act with courage and sacrifice actually demands something that none of the brothers, except maybe young Benjamin, possess. And that's a clean conscience. They don't have a clean conscience. And so they can't trust God with the future because they haven't yet entrusted God with their past. Because they lied to their dad about Joseph, his grief over something that didn't even happen took over his life. And because the grief took over his life, it took over their lives. And so now their lives are totally consumed by overcompensating for their dad's inordinate grief. And that's why throughout the whole Joseph story, you keep hearing the brothers saying, "What will Dad think if this happens? What will happen if this happens? How will Dad feel if this happens? What if something happens to Benjamin? Oh, what'll happen to Dad then?" It's like, "Oh, Dad, oh, Dad, oh, Dad." Dad is bound, the brothers are bound, and it's all because of sin. That's what sin does. Sin shackles. Sin gets its meat hooks into us, and it doesn't let go. We have to be delivered from an outside source. The lie they told their father became the most dominant thing in their life. And now it's been going on for 20 years, and upholding the lie with all of its resulting dysfunction has just kept the brothers completely shackled. To quote Walter Brueggemann, "The brothers cannot be open to any new possibility, either as a new gift from God or as a fresh work of Joseph." They're stuck. You know, sometimes I'm like those guys, and so are you. And the future looks like a fog. And there's trouble, but there's no courage to act. And the reason why there's no courage to act is because something has happened in the past that has not been dealt with. And often when I sit with people, with you, and we talk about your life, your journey, and we share journey together, you will often say to me, "I'm just so stuck and the future looks so dark, and I'm really feeling hopeless." And often when that happens, we talk about, could there be something in the past that's holding you back from seeing the future with hope? And we pray into that, and we ask God to reveal what might be in the past. And so many times, and if you've met me in my office, you've probably heard me say something like this, if you've been in a tough time. I've said, in your darkness, when you don't understand the past, or the past is unresolved, and as a result, the future looks bleak, watch how God will send his ravens with little morsels of bread and meat. Little morsels of grace. It's all you can handle. But when an unlikely source flies into your life and drops you a sacrament of God's grace, make sure you say thank you to God. Because one of the ways for your eyes to be opened to the past and the future is for you to acknowledge the goodness of God in your life now. So every time somebody calls you and says, come for coffee, or every time you see a beautiful sunset, or when you see the tulips poking up this spring, say, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And upon a foundation of gratitude, the light will begin to come. Let's look at the father's grief for a minute. The brother's guilt is pretty obvious, but the father is grieving, and of course he is. We looked at this painting last week, the next one. It's coming. There it is. The father has just found out in this painting that Joseph is apparently dead, and he begins to sob. And I've never lost an adult child, and I hope I never have to. You know, parents anticipate living longer than their kids. And when children die before the parents, I think it is the most crushing thing. I hope I never have to experience that. And so I don't want to be cavalier about this point, but I do want us to see something that is here that I think we're supposed to see, and that is that Jacob's life has been defined by a deception, by a lie. And this always accompanies sin. Sin never just comes into a person's life or a family and tells the truth. It always tells untruths. And as a result, all of Jacob's decisions and actions for the whole rest of his life, at least for 20 years, are influenced by that deception. Now, of course, the most obvious deception is that Jacob, or Joseph, is alive. He is not dead. You can't blame him for that. He has been told that Joseph is dead. But a more insidious deception is Jacob's belief that life isn't worth living without Joseph. Because Joseph has attained godlike status with Jacob, neither of them are free. The father is bound and Joseph is bound. You can actually love your child too much. And you can love your spouse too much. And I think one of the reasons why going to a counselor or a therapist from time to time, the reason it's so liberating is because these people are trained to help us see the various lies that have shaped our lives and the subsequent idolatries that have resulted. I've told you about a girl that I know who, when she was in high school and going through a very difficult time, both physically and emotionally, one of her teachers, who had high hopes for her, got discouraged with her performance, and one day in the hall, he said to her, "You are going to fail at school and you're going to fail at life." And this girl, by God's amazing grace, has not failed at school, and she has not failed at life. In fact, she's now the kind of woman who's so successful, I've told her this, I'd like to parade her back to her high school and reintroduce her to that teacher and say, take a look at this woman, mother, business owner who's now making a whole lot more money than you. Now, of course, I would never do that because I'm too holy to do that. But listen, when a person in power that you like speaks words like that, that plants a narrative in your life that you will hear your entire life, and someone has to come from the outside and yank that lie out. Identify it and speak the truth into it. Those words are not true, but they wield power over a person as if they were true. Joseph is dead. No, actually, he's not. But the greater lie, I cannot live without Joseph. That's just as big of a lie. Yes, you can. But I've chosen not to. Okay. You know, last week we talked about the whole Me Too thing that's going on, and we saw that Tamar is really a beautiful picture of the Me Too generation because she's a woman in a sex-crazed culture, a Canaanite culture. Just Google Canaanite sometime and you'll see what I mean. And she has all these men in her life that just use her as a sex object. And so she can easily begin to believe that this is what women are for. Women are for the satisfaction of men in power, their sex drives. That becomes the dominant narrative of their life. And we saw how God redeemed Tamar's situation. But when young girls and teens and young adults are violated by men whom they thought could be trusted, they were good men, so men like fathers, grandfathers, uncles, employers, boyfriends, dates, when they said, I thought this person could be trusted and they couldn't, and the girl was taken advantage of, there is a lie implanted in the girl's life about what women are for. Women are to be used sexually to satisfy men. And so some women, that lie actually makes them throw themselves at more men in highly promiscuous ways. And for other women, depending on their makeup, they turn away from men completely and they actually oppose on all men what only a few men are guilty of. And they end up hating men. They say men are dot, dot, dot. Well, that's actually a lie. Not all men are dot, 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 but the lie is implanted in them. It becomes the narrative. Young boys, when they're 5, 6, 7 years old and they're on their heroic journey, they need their mom and their dad and certain people in their life to tell them, good job, good job, good catch, good shot. You got to be this time. That's so good. Way to go, kid. And we cheer them on their young heroic journey. If those boys do not have those adults in their life, there's a narrative that's planted in them that they will never, ever succeed in the normal way, and they're going to have to find other ways to succeed, like joining a gang. Those guys will love me. My father and my mother might not, but those guys will accept me. Secondly, even if Joseph was dead, Jacob made a decision early in the grief process that he would never recover from his grief. He said, in mourning will I go down to the grave. Really? And 20 years later, he's upholding this rash vow, only this time it's about the threat of losing Benjamin. He says, quote, if harm comes to him, you will bring my gray head down to the grave in sorrow. In other words, guys, I vow to never recover if I lose Benjamin. If I lose the rest of you guys, I'll be fine. But if I lose Benjamin? And as a result of that vow to never recover, Jacob refuses to risk. Because he refuses to let go of his grief, he refuses to let go of Benjamin. His whole life is now bound up in keeping his other favorite son alive. So Jacob now is assuming the role of God in Benjamin's life. And because of that, neither of them are free. Jacob actually decides to become Benjamin's shield and protector. And it's really hard for us as parents, because when our parents are young, we make all kinds of decisions. We send them to good schools, we put them into programs, we put them into sports. We come around, we nurture, protect. But then they get to a certain point and we need to push them out of the nest and let them go and say, oh God, this job is now too big for me. I'll always be a parent, but my parenting is gonna have to shift. It's gonna have to change. I release my, in fact, when a dad gives his daughter away in marriage, that's exactly what is happening. He's saying, I give you away. And that man is now responsible for you, not me anymore. And Jacob couldn't do that because of the pain of the past and because of the lie of the past. I can't live without you. I will not live with you. I will never recover from the pain of losing Joseph, and I will not recover if I lose Benjamin. And it's interesting that sin is so complex. Early in Israel's history, God told Moses, he said, listen, your people, the nation of Israel, are going to find it easy to make very rash vows to protect themselves from future pain. They will say things like, never again will I be truly happy, or never again will I allow myself to be taken advantage of like that again. Never again will I risk intimacy. I tried that once and it didn't work. Never again will I, you know, join a church because, well, I went to a church once and I got really hurt by that church, so I'm done with church. So I make a vow, I promise. And God said to Moses, you tell the people that if they ever get to the place in their life where they remember that they made a rash vow, whether it was good or evil, it doesn't matter, in any matter they might carelessly swear about it, you tell them that the moment they remember their vow, they are guilty and they must slaughter an animal and make a sacrifice, or the vow will bind them to the past. And I've told you stories about vows that I made after my mother died to keep the lid on my life and make sure that I have no future grief or difficulty like that again. Secondly, boy, we could talk about the sin part for a long time. The redemptive action of God, though he appears silent and hidden. Thankfully, God specializes in moving into our darkness and dysfunction and releasing us and freeing us from these things. Look at verse 6. Now Joseph was governor in the land. Okay. Now Joseph. Yes, things in the covenant family are tense, they're broken, they're governed by fear, but sin is not going to be the last word in this family. Grace will be the last word, but Joseph, and Joseph here now becomes the Christ figure for us. We might as well be saying, now Jesus was the Lord of the universe. And do you see what's happening here? Let's read from verse 6 to 11. Now Joseph was the governor of the land, the one who sold grain to all its people. So when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. And as soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them. But he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. Where do you come from? He asked. From the land of Canaan, they replied, to buy food. Although Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. Then he remembered his dreams. Okay, you want to underline that. If you have an old-fashioned Bible with paper and ink, underline that. Now, I know you can do that on your phone, too. Underline that. Then he remembered his dreams. We're going to come to that. About them, and said to them, you are spies. You have come to see where our land is unprotected. No, my lord, they answered, your servants have come to buy food. We are all the sons of one man. Your servants are honest men, not spies.
For the first time in two decades, we see the beginning of Joseph's dream being fulfilled. You just wonder if, when did Joseph actually forget the original dream that his brothers would bow down to him? What difficulty was it? The failed seduction, being tossed into prison, being forgotten by the baker, you know. When, was it after 10 years or 15 years? But now, 20 years later, the dream is coming true. It's happening. Wow, look at that. It's happening. It took 20 years. The redemptive action of God, though he appears silent and hidden. It seems that for most of us, you know, there seems to be a pretty significant amount of time between the promise of the kind of abundant life that God has promised to give us and that we want to experience, and the reality of that promise. There seems to be a time where we wait and we fight and we struggle, but as Tim Keller said, God's silence is not impotence and his hiddenness is not absence. God is always faithful to all of his promises, and God is always at work. But for so much of our life, we actually don't see evidence of it. That's why committing to the disciplines of word and sacrament at least once a week is just a no-brainer. We just have to do it. Because the word shakes us and realigns us with the truth, and the sacrament is actually something I can taste and touch and smell and digest when it doesn't seem like God is anywhere here. But don't get me going on that. God's silence is not to be confused with impotence, nor his hiddenness as absence. In Joseph, there has had to have been a kind of death, a J-curve, a death and a resurrection and an ascension. Of course there is. Redemption always, somebody always dies. And Joseph, though he is in that position now, was not always in that position. He had to say to God, I release to you my future and my life. Do with it as you will. And God said, oh, I will. And he did. Are there areas in your life where God's redemptive action just seems a little invisible right now? You've been praying for things and longing for things, and it just hasn't happened. Well, don't lose heart, dear church. I talked to a person recently, and they told me that they had a dream that they felt God gave them in grade 6. And the dream was of a certain kind of life, a God-shaped life, a beautiful life, where this person was going to be a certain kind of person. But then, life happened. And now, this person said, life doesn't look at all like that dream. There's a lot of brokenness, and there's a lot of despair, and the future looks very foggy. And I'm afraid that that dream is not going to come true. And it was very honest and very sweet. And I said, well, what I think you should do is you should ask God to reinforce the truth of that dream. And if it was a faulty dream or you just dreamed it up yourself, that God would reveal that to you and would give you another dream. But if God doesn't give you another dream and doesn't reveal to you that the first dream you had is a false dream, then I think you need to bank on that dream happening, but also add to that that this season of life you're in right now is absolutely necessary for you to build the kind of character that can support the dream. You just don't go from the dream to its reality without a death and a burial somewhere. And during these 20 years, God did something very wonderful in the life of Joseph. But boy, did he pay the price, and all of us do. But dear church, don't lose hope. How long did Eve have to wait when she heard the words, the serpent that deceived you will bite your seed on the heel, but your seed will crush the head of the serpent. How many thousands of years? How long did Israel have to wait when they heard the prophets say, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder"? They heard that when they were in exile and there was no such son anywhere being born where the government was upon his shoulder. They had to wait for 70 years, first of all, for the exile to be over, and then another 500 or 600 years for this particular son to be born, Jesus, the Messiah. How long have the martyrs who are under the throne, how long have they been praying, "How long, O Lord, until you avenge our blood"? How long has the suffering church worldwide been praying, "Even so, Lord Jesus, come"? This is our lot. We cling to God's promise and God's faithfulness, and we wait for the promise to be fulfilled. God's silence is not to be confused as impotence, nor his hiddenness as absence. And the reason we can say that with confidence is not because we always feel this faith, you know, growing in us. No, it's because we know the storyline, and we tell ourselves the storyline over and over and over, and we bank our lives on the story. And the story is creation, fall, promise, redemption, right? Church, new creation. And we sing that song every Sunday, and we preach that message every Sunday, and we remind ourselves daily of that story in our own private lives. Is this not what Palm Sunday is about? Palm Sunday is about waiting, waiting in the city now for God's salvation to be revealed through the king who's just arrived on a donkey. Hosanna! God save us! This is it. It's time. Kick the Romans' butt. Here we go. What do we need? Do we need swords? Let's go, Jesus. Hosanna. Is this not what Easter weekend is all about? I mean, what do God's people do on Saturday between Good Friday and Easter? We wait on Holy Saturday for God to somehow make good the horrible things that happened on Friday. So on Palm Sunday, we shout, "The King has arrived." And then on Good Friday, we lament, "The King is dead." And then on Holy Saturday, we lament some more, "The King is buried." But on Easter Sunday, we sing and dance, "The King is risen," all in one week, this week, in our liturgical calendar. That's why we have the beautiful red up here today. It all begins. And finally, number three, we see in our story grace and forgiveness extended, but at the expense of a substitute, and we don't have time to read the lengthy narratives, but let me give you the Coles Notes version. Joseph, wanting to test his brother's integrity to see if there had been a change in their hearts over the last number of years, plans this sting operation. He puts a bunch of grain in their sacks, and he sends them on their way back to their father. And it's just enough grain to keep them going probably for a few weeks or maybe months. And then he says, "When you come back for, you know, the mother load, for what you're really going to need, just know that you need to bring your youngest brother with you." And the guys freak out, and they tear their clothes, and they go, "You don't understand. Our father is completely enmeshed in the youngest brother. You see, there was this other guy that you don't know about. His name was Joseph. It was the same deal with him." And Joseph's going, "Oh man, I know. I know. I know the story. I know the narrative." So they objected. They objected. But Joseph just said, "You want more stuff? You bring your younger brother." And so they took off with their sacks filled with grain. They were between a rock and a hard place, the brothers. They were trying to figure out, "How are we going to do this? How are we going to get Dad to let Benjamin go?" And they left Joseph as free men, not only with their bags full of grain, but Joseph also secretly placed their money, their silver, back in their sacks, so that when they got home and they opened their sacks, not only was there grain, but all the money. So in other words, they got the stuff for free. He wouldn't take their money. Because this is a story of redemption, they couldn't pay for it themselves. Somebody else had to pay for it. This was a gift of grace. It was undeserved. They could never, ever leave going, "I'm sure glad we had enough cash to buy this grain." Then it wouldn't be a story of redemption. But while everybody is going home with bags full of grain and money, I forgot this part. One man had to stay behind. One man had to give his life as surety for the others. Last week, remember, it was Judah who did it for Benjamin. Now it's Simeon who becomes the Christ figure. Simeon remains as Joseph's prisoner. Verse 24 says, "He had Simeon taken from them and bound before their eyes, and then said, 'Away you go.'" And we can't help but think of Jesus, our substitute, who was bound before our eyes, and we got to go free. The Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. Wounded for our transgressions, bruised for our iniquities. The guilty brothers leave Egypt free and wealthy, but one man, their brother, is bound and enslaved. Somebody always pays. And by chapter 50, let's take a look at this next slide. This was painted in the late 1800s, and Tissot made Joseph look like a 1980s rock star. But there is something else that Tissot is doing. Behold the man. Joseph's position is called a cruciform position. Behold the man. He says to them in chapter 50, "I am your brother. I am your brother." It's what Jesus is saying to all of us right now. I am your brother. And yes, you hated me, and you sold me, and you betrayed me, and you pushed me away. But don't be afraid. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. This is what Jesus is saying on the cross. I came to you, and look what you did to me, but it's okay. It's okay. I just wonder if there's somebody here today in church and you need to embrace this truth for you because you have tried to atone and make up for your own sin. You've just tried creative ways to pay God back to make up for your past mistakes. And today God is saying, give it up. You can't do it. You can't do it. I've sent somebody who has done it for you. Just trust Jesus and just receive it. He has forgiven you. Forgive yourself. You can sing, "I'm forgiven because you were forsaken. I'm accepted. You were condemned. I'm alive and well. Your spirit lives within me because you died and rose again." What a beautiful story the story of Joseph is. It's just layer after layer after layer of good news of the grace of God.